Van, John, I have maintained from the beginning that the reason for the secrecy is the fact that if this principle of power gets out, it is so simple any average good mechanic could make a motor that would run, and it doesn't require fuel to operate. That, in my estimation, is the prime reason that this fact has not been revealed. That, and the fact that various information relative to that particular power and the things that have been found out since atomic energy has been gone into, has made practically every scientific book in our school today obsolete. They are behind the times. And the kids going to high school today read advanced things in popular science. And those kids don't object to learning, but they do object to learning things that are has been material. That is the situation as I have analyzed it and I discussed it with many parents and many teenagers. And this whole condition is bringing about something that is unhealthy for our country, because as I have said before, the strength of our country depends upon the people having confidence in their government, in their form of government, and the people responsible in government office. I just don't like to see the truth hidden. This is something that concerns everybody. LJ, you use the word, truth. You feel very confident that you know what you're talking about? Van, positively confident. Yes. LJ, Howard Menger, you have been listening to George Van Tassel. Did you ever hear of George Van Tassel prior to his lecture in New York, October, 1956? Howard, yes, I did, and that's as far as I would like to go. LJ, surprised, that is as far as you'd like to go? Howard, yes, I have answered the question. LJ, even George Van Tassel seems amazed at that one. Am I right, George? Van, well, I'll tell you, John, in dealing with these space people you find there have been a number of things that they have told various Earth people. I could not figure out how he, Howard, knew I was here in New York or how he knew where I was staying in New York, so I haven't had even the chance to ask him these things myself. LJ, well, I must say there is certainly an air of mystery about the entire situation. Chapter 14 clarifies this mystery. After this first broadcast as guests of Long John Nebel, we had many return engagements. In March, 1957, I headed west for a brief lecture tour, to be followed 2 months later by a month's tour of the entire nation. During both tours, I stopped at Van's place at Giant Rock Airport, Yucca Valley, California. I also spent a few inspiring hours with George Adamski, a great soul who has reached an awareness of the truth of our being and our purpose. I shall never forget that warm, friendly meeting and his words of wisdom. In April, 1957, Mr. Lester and I made a cross-country trip, during which I had several contacts. The most interesting contact occurred in Hollywood, California, where Mr. Lester and I were staying at a motel on Sunset Boulevard. At 2:31 morning, while he lay sleeping soundly, I was awakened by a strong impulse. I got up, dressed quietly, and went out into the foggy pre-dawn. I walked a few blocks, trying to beam in the impulse guiding me. I entered an all-night restaurant to have a cup of coffee and ask directions. I knew a contact was near, but I wasn't quite sure where or when it would take place. Mr. Lester is a pseudonym. I looked around the restaurant. 6 or 7 people were in various stages of devouring slivers of pie and cups of coffee. But sitting on stools at the counter, with their backs toward me, were a man and woman. The man, in particular, attracted my attention, for I was almost certain that a mental emanation came from him. I hesitated for a moment, then mentally asked him if he was my contact. He turned around, looked directly at me and nodded. So I went over to the counter and greeted them. The woman moved over one seat and indicated I should sit between them. Sitting between these two people, I again had the usual exhilarating feeling of love and friendship. The man was a pleasant individual, with brown wavy hair, a medium build, ruddy complexion and smiling eyes. I remember that he rather reminded me of John Garfield. The woman also had wavy brown hair. Her eyes were dark, and her skin white and camellia-like. She wore no makeup except for the faintest suggestion of lipstick. She was small and slender, with a sweet, gentle face. She did not speak at all. "Howard, I trust your companion is sleeping well? He is sleeping like a log, and I am surprised he didn't wake up when I got up, because he is a light sleeper." I was reminded how that whenever I had a mission to do, I could always leave my house without attracting attention. I wondered why the rest of the household always slept so soundly. We spoke about my trip and the lectures, and he asked me how I liked California. I told him I liked it very much and would someday like to live there, because some parts of it reminded me of the world of the Space Friends. Then, as if he had overlooked it, he smiled apologetically and said he should introduce themselves. He was Suna and his gentle companion, Karma. Both were aliens. "I am known as Suna by the contacts on your planet, but as you know, we are not known by such names on our own planet." I was surprised and somewhat suspicious at hearing the names, for this was the first time I had been given actual names. Maybe these people were only posing as contacts. Anybody could act like a space visitor, especially if he had the ability to communicate telepathically. He immediately picked up my doubts, smiled, and then my eyes were drawn toward his. As I watched him, his right eye turned to a very light gray, then back to brown. Then he did the same thing with his left eye. I must say that thoroughly convinced me. Then I reasoned that by having names, space visitors could be easily identified and referred to by other contacts. It would facilitate our work. Sensing I accepted him, he explained he had been on this planet for some time and had taken on the complexion of terrestrials. But I saw a look of pleasant expectancy on his face as he said he soon would be returning to his home planet. "I have followed you all across the country," he told me, "and will continue to do so. When it is advantageous, I will make myself known to you and to witnesses." He said a photograph would be taken in which he would appear with a crowd of people, and that I could use the photograph if I wished for my book. We discussed my group back home, and he suggested I stop pushing them too hard, for it was difficult for them to understand some of the concepts. I had begun teaching by briefing them on the space people as to where they came from and their purpose. Then they had a brief course in Scientology, recommended by a space contact. Next, I gradually introduced them to the study of metaphysics. I hoped to make teachers of some of the group so they would be able to have their own contacts and carry on the work. Suna suggested it might prove well worth the time for our group to study self-realization, as taught by a great teacher, Paramahamsa Yogananda. That was where Mr. Lester, with his knowledge and devotion to the study of yoga, could greatly help us. I should allow him to proceed with the teachings in his own way. Abruptly Suna said, "And while you are up there on the platform at Giant Rock, you can take my picture." This came as a shock to me, for I had not anticipated attending the spacecraft convention, however I had learned always to follow their suggestions. So Les and I headed toward Yucca Valley. While I was on the platform giving a brief talk, surely enough I spotted Suna in the audience, asked for my Polaroid camera to be reached up to me, and snapped a picture of him in the audience. I hoped he would be visible in the finished print. On the way back to New Jersey, Suna and Karma made their presence known in various ways, and I was happy to know they were always near. One time Suna left a sign on the entrance door at a lecture hall in a Chicago hotel, and I called it to the attention of John Otto, who was sponsoring my appearance. In the summer of 1957 my son Robert left this earth. He was brave, cheerful and brilliant to the last. A few months later my dad passed on. Within 2 years there had been 4 deaths in my immediate family. Everything in my personal life seemed to be coming to a head. Business dropped off. The manager of a large beverage company, one of my largest accounts, called me in to tell me that because of my story of the space people, my services were no longer wanted. If at any time I felt ready to quit, that was the time. I had to make a decision, whether to conform and appease, or to devote all my time and energy to spreading of the knowledge. I chose the latter. When I gave up the sign painting business, my financial position became precarious. Yet, in the back of my mind, I knew that with positive thinking I would be able to solve such earthly problems. To be almost alone in a crusade was not easy. My concepts and understanding had been expanded with the wonderful knowledge I had learned from my space friends. But to interpret those concepts in our society was difficult. Many unpleasant situations arose, due to their misunderstanding and misinterpretation of my acts. When I started to spread the message of love, I meant a sacred, spiritual love, for a person or persons. A spiritual love which expresses through that one small spark of the infinite Father present within each of us. This is an impersonal love expressed to all. Some experiments I attempted with the groups and with certain individuals in the group failed, yet some succeeded. At the end of 1957, I gave the group over into capable hands and secluded myself so that I could study, put down my experiences in this manuscript, bring forth the music that had been given me, and to go through further training for the even greater work ahead. 24. Project Moon. As my space friends had promised, they took me on my first trip to the moon the second week of August, 1956. It began with my receiving a telephone call from a man in Pennsylvania. I had been working with this man for some time. He was a well-known citizen in his community, a successful businessman who donated all his spare time to establishing contacts, disseminating information, and assisting the space people in their work between the Earth and Moon. When I picked up the phone and heard his voice, I was impressed, for I realized he was a very important person among those carrying out the work on Earth. I remembered how one time he had asked me for a list of people who, in my opinion, would be good contacts, dependable and trustworthy. I eventually gave him such a list, then learned two of the people on the list had been contacted by the space people. One of the two people had talked to me considerably about his contact. This individual had been given samples of processed food from the moon, which he had kept in his possessions for 8 months, not being sure what he should do with it, and asked my advice. I suggested that we arrange to have one specimen, a processed potato from the moon, analyzed by a reputable laboratory. So we went to the largest laboratory in Philadelphia and left the sample with them, then waited for the report. We classified the sample as an unknown, though later we told them what it was. Their analysis came back as follows: total weight of sample 5.20 grams, moisture 7.23%, ash 4.49% fat, ether extract 0.95%, NS protein, NX6.25 15.12%. Reading the report, we were immediately struck by the most unusual point in the analysis. Our own potatoes grown on Earth do not contain more than 2 or 3% protein. Next, we decided to obtain a carbon-14 test to determine the age of the potatoes, since we had been informed these processed food products could last indefinitely. My wife, Marla, and I were going to the West Coast to do some research for a few months, so I left the specimens in charge of the individual who had obtained them. When we returned, we learned no report had come from the lab. We decided to go to Philadelphia and talk to the man in charge of the analysis. Marla Baxter and I were married in May, 1958. He informed us they had not proceeded with the carbon-14 test because they needed a written authorization to do so, and that the cost of the test would approach $2,000. At that point we were glad they had not proceeded, for while we had paid for the previous test, we could not afford that larger price. The doctor, very polite and interested, suggested I take their lab report and the specimens to a government agency, whose address he gave me, and volunteered that if any of the scientists of that agency had any questions about the previous analysis, he would be glad to cooperate with them. We thanked him and left. When we returned home, we immediately called up the individual from whom I had obtained the sample, and who had not been able to make the Philadelphia trip with us, asked him to go with us to the agency the laboratory had recommended. 2 days later we went there, where we were advised as to which of their research labs we should take it. Finally we arrived at the lab itself, where we talked to Dr., a polite, intelligent man who appeared to be completely fascinated with the specimens presented him. He assured us he would immediately get to work on a thorough analysis, and that there would be no charge to us. We left the samples with him, feeling we were on the right road. About 2 weeks later, my wife, my friend and I went to the lab to check on the progress of the analysis. We were shown into a room where a piece of a specimen was in a container of water, another piece was in another container, and a small fragment was under a huge microscope. We took turns looking through the microscope. Through the microscope, the outer surface of the specimen appeared like a crystalline beach of sand. It was beautiful to look at. My wife suggested the crystalline effect could be due to an intense contraction of structure. I then told him what had been explained to me about the method of collapsing the molecular structure, which probably gave the potato a dehydrated nature. My friend suggested they plant one of the specimens in the ground to see if it would grow. We were told they would run all sorts of tests on the specimens left with them and keep us informed, and that we were also welcome to come to the lab any time we wished to watch the progress of the experiments. Since my friend had been given the potatoes in the first place, we left the arrangements in his hands. That was in June 1958, and the last we heard from the laboratory. I understand that it has now become classified information, and the reason I am including this is because I believe such knowledge belongs to all the people, not left in the hands of a few. But back to the man responsible for my friend's having the potato in the first place. The businessman from Pennsylvania. At this suggestion I met him at a small restaurant off Route 22 near West Portal, NJ. He gave me a date and time to go to a certain location in Pennsylvania, already familiar to me. A few days later I went to Bisseca's Diner, Route 611, in Pennsylvania, and again met my friend. This time he was accompanied by a young couple. The man appeared to be about 20 years old. Later I found he was 79, was of average height. His hair looked as if it had recently been cut to a shorter style. His woman companion wore her strawberry blonde hair shoulder length and had a faint trace of lipstick. She, I later found out, was 69 Earth years old. They told me they had been on Earth 1 week, having come here from a base on Mars, yet they already spoke English, Russian and German fluently. They explained they had learned to speak the three languages by the aid of a device which I can best describe as an ampli converter. The young man explained it something like this: the would-be student of a new language is seated comfortably in a chair facing a view screen. An electrode is connected to each temple and wires run from the head to a small instrument about the size of a portable radio. This instrument is an electric memory brain which contains the electronic thought patterns expressed by the words through sonic vibrations fed into the machine by a previously recorded voice speaking the language and at the same time thinking of what the converted words mean. By this ingenious device the student is able to learn any language quickly, because the visual and audio transmissions are equally impressed on the brain cells. In addition, the electrodes connected to the temples impress the memory cells of the brain so that it retains the ability to speak and understand the language. The young man then told me I myself could conduct experiments which would at least demonstrate the process and prove that brain impulses, as related to our thoughts, can be picked up through the use of electronics, and with an ordinary six-tube radio and a tape recorder. At a later date in the home of a friend, Art R.O., of California, our host, Mr. Lester and I tried the experiment and did prove to ourselves that brain impulses could be changed to electrical energy and then to sound energy. Mr. Lester agreed to be the subject, so we hooked two electrodes to each temple, then made connections to the loop antenna of the radio, one to the ground, another to the condenser. Then we connected the tape recorder into the somewhat odd circuit. We looked at Mr. Lester sitting there with the electrodes attached and Art asked him very sanctimoniously, Do you have any last words? Then I burst out laughing as I saw the ludicrous similarity to a formal electrocution. But Mr. Lester's unperturbed and serious manner got the two of us serious again, and I instructed him to concentrate upon a constructive line of thought. We clicked the recorder to record position and waited. When we thought we had recorded a long enough sequence, we reversed the tape, then played it back. I suppose we had half expected to hear a voice similar to Mr. Lester's on the playback, but instead we heard sounds very similar to teletype transmission code one can hear on the shortwave band of radio. We assumed the sound came from the conversion of the brain impulses into sound. I have purposefully left out certain details of the hookup so that this experiment will not be done by amateurs. For if the chassis of the radio ray tapped in a hot place, the experiment could cause serious electrical shock. They had specified a Philco 6-tube radio, incidentally, for the experiment. However, we tried it with a console-type radio, and that may have been why the results were not as good as we had expected. But we did get results. Later, another contact suggested I carry on further experiments along this line with an electronics engineer and to try and establish a method of changing the sound energy, as received on the tape as an audible teletype-like code, to light energy by way of a screen, thus making it possible for Aneto see his own thoughts. But I have digressed again, and now let us get back to the meeting with my friend and the young space couple at the restaurant. After finishing eating, we went out, got into my car and talked further. They mentioned three men who were slated for work on Project Moon, as they termed the work we would do. This would involve receiving samples of processed extraterrestrial food, plus foods from the Earth processed on the Moon, though at the time I did not understand the significance of the work and wondered where its value laid. But I was so overjoyed at the prospect of making a trip to the Moon, I asked few questions at that time. Two of the three men they mentioned would not work out, because of the attitude of their wives. If they found it necessary to be away evenings without sufficient explanation, and they wouldn't be permitted to explain fully, their families could conceivably be broken up. The man paused in his talk and rolled up the windows of the car, as I wondered about his unusual action, for it was a very hot day. Just for a minute, he apologized. I noted his tone was becoming more confidential. Howard, as far as I know, you've been shielded from what I now have to tell you, but it is necessary for you to know. You're becoming too widely known and it may happen to you. I tensed, worriedly. This was the first time I had been spoken to in such fashion. The man sounded as if some danger threatened. Any of these men working with us, including you, may be approached by false contacts. They may be able even to present you with authentic specimens of processed food. Who are these people? I thought I could listen to any of you. They're not US, Howard. There are others operating. I'll speak of them simply as the conspiracy. I was further shocked and taken aback as they described a certain man, possessed of so much knowledge of space activity and such an operator of deceit, he would confront us with extraterrestrial specimens and might even arrange a trip to the Moon, while all of this would be backed by a libelous story against our space brothers. Many gullible people would be unwitting helpers to this conspiracy. I, too, would on one occasion become victim to the belief that I had contacted a space person and later find out this was not so. They described the operator to me. A man about 40, with brown hair, graying at the temples. Average height, about 160 pounds. He smoked cigarettes, but occasionally cigars, usually wore dark brown suits, black shoes, drove a late model car and lived in the vicinity of Somerville, NJ. While reading, he usually wore dark rimmed glasses. His movements were described as quick and alert. I wondered as I listened incredulously. If this were true, how could we determine who was our friend and who our enemy? I could see friends divided by suspicions and reluctance to trust former confidences. With my mind in a whirl, I thought, suppose one were contacted by an alien and were sworn to secrecy on the promise of future contacts and trips in spacecraft. How could one know he was not being contacted by a real space brother? As a matter of fact, could I really be sure the people I was then talking with were representatives of the real space brotherhood who wished humankind well? The man looked at me sadly. My friend, this Earth is the battlefield of Armageddon, and the battle is for men's minds and souls. Prayer, good thoughts and caution are your best insulation. I shouldn't have doubted these people for a moment, but I was quite ill at ease. I had been sheltered from the knowledge that all of the space people's work on this planet is not sweetness and light. The others I had contacted must have been on the right side, for what I had seen of their mode of travel, their way of life, their courtesy and goodwill toward each other and all mankind, convinced me they were a good people. Then the young lady spoke, "You don't know, Howard, that there is a very powerful group on this planet, which possesses tremendous knowledge of technology, psychology, and most unfortunate of all, advanced brain therapy. They are using certain key people in the governments of your world. This group is anti-God, and might be termed instruments of your mythical Satan." I listened, aghast. I remembered that at one of my lectures a little old woman, wild and strange looking, had motioned me aside. She had whispered into my ear, seemingly afraid she would be overheard, something of dark forces, which were everywhere. I had remonstrated that the space people were good, and that was that, feeling the unusual little lady had lost her faculties. In the light of what I was hearing, the recollection of their old woman's tale became frightening. When I felt I knew everything, I had indeed become, in some respect, an overbearing sophist, the type of attitude I had hated when I saw it in others. "They use people not only from this planet," the young lady continued, "but people from other planets as well. And also," and she looked at her companion, he nodded his assent, "also other people of your OWN planet, people you don't know about. People who live unobserved and undiscovered as yet. It is a kind of underground, in your popular terminology. This group has been infiltrating religious organizations to dupe your peoples into a distorted concept of a truth which enveloped your planet many years ago. They are using the credulity and simple faith of many people to attain their own ends." For the first time there was anger and frustration in her voice. 25, Orbit. Apparently that was all they were going to tell me about the unpleasant subject, for the young couple got out of the car, went to their own car and indicated we should follow. We drove out Route 115 toward Mount Effort. When we approached the Blue Mountain area, we turned off onto a dirt road and I recognized a familiar spot. I remembered that a transmitting instrument had been placed nearby some time ago. My friend got out of my car to inspect the instrument and I followed. I knew the instrument was tuned into at least 50 individuals, three of whom lived in Allentown, PA. Their brains were acting as transmitting units for the instrument, although they were unaware of the fact and in no way affected in their health or free will. That business effected, we got back into the car and followed the lead car as it again pulled out onto the road. We drove for about 3 miles, turned off on another dirt road and traveled for three more. We approached a clearing where I made out two craft with a small crowd of people standing around them. At the entrance to the field stood a young man waving an instrument which emitted purple light and which I suspected registered our brain impulses. We left the cars and approached the man waving us in. "Hello, you're late." 10 minutes later the tower would have been dismantled and all of us gone. We apologized. As we walked toward the smaller craft we noticed 10 or 15 men who began to dismantle a 10-foot structure which was surmounted by revolving red lights. By the time we reached the craft, the structure had been completely dismantled into sections and was being loaded aboard the larger ship. I marveled at the rapidity with which they had accomplished the work. We mounted the ramp, entered the craft, sat down at a large round translucent table. I looked out and saw the ramp being retracted as the iris-like doorway closed. Then we heard a high-pitched humming sound as the craft prepared to take off. I still wasn't sure where we were going. The young lady, reading my thoughts, informed me, "I'm not absolutely sure, but I feel certain we're going to orbit the moon once or twice." The lights dimmed as the man at the controls pushed some buttons and the view screen lighted with a view of the moon's surface, which I guessed was about 25 miles away.